Hi, everybody. I'm Brian Kiley.
I'm Judah Sanders.
And this is Engaging Culture, a podcast presented by Bridgeway Christian Church. On today's episode, we're going to talk a bit about why we have not talked much about the election and how we ourselves are preparing ourselves to participate in the 2024 election. We'll talk about how we define success and how we could think about that concept in a more healthy manner. And we'll discuss euthanasia and how particularly the church in Canada is grappling with a culture that is becoming more comfortable with it. All of that and more on this episode of Engaging Culture. Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Engaging Culture Podcast. We were not with you last week because we recorded an entire episode and then found out 2 days later that the recording didn't work. But that is not going to happen this week, is it, Pastor Judah?
In Jesus' name, where are the worship, prayer, and healing intercessor teams?
That's right. Well, appreciate y'all being with us. Good to see you as always, Pastor Judah.
Amen.
What is your best thing you saw this week?
So the best thing I saw this week, we had worship, prayer, and healing last night. And I was praying with folks, and a little boy came into my line, and this kid has to be like 8. And he said that he was really grieving about the war in Ukraine and asked for that to be what we prayed about together. And that just really, you know, the war in Ukraine is a really sad thing, but I was really just moved to see that, like, young people are engaged in that. He had like the awareness to like be concerned about something outside of, you know, second grade and running out of goldfish or, you know, whatever. And I just think that this is a great time and a great opportunity to just to remind people that there are still folks suffering in Ukraine, in Gaza, in the Congo, and in many other places, Sudan, in many other places that we should be praying about regularly.
Yep.
So that was super dope.
Yeah.
What about you?
Good. Yeah. Worship, prayer, and healing night was, I mean, that's always a special night in a lot of ways, but I'm going to cheat and I'm going to give you two. So number one, I was reflecting on kind of how the fast has gone for me this time around. And I'll be real honest about the fact that I often use the fast to kind of get a handle on some bad habits in my life and just allow sort of the absence of those things to prompt me to prayer and things like that. And I have a terrible relationship with email. I check email compulsively, and it is absurd because I don't get that much email. I could easily check my email a few times a day and be fine. And yet it's just sort of like the default, like, walk into the bathrooms. I don't even know. I would probably be embarrassed to know the number, but it's just kind of the like, oh, well, here's the thing. So yeah, it's like my default, like sitting at a stoplight, waiting in line at the store, whatever, just check your email. There's just no need for it for me to check it that often. And one of the things I did during the fast was I'm only allowed to check email 4 times a day and not on my phone.
Only four.
So yeah.
You do check it too
much. Yeah, Judah's going like, yeah, 4 times a week. That's about right, isn't
it? That's the goal. But, like if I can get to 4 times a day.
Yeah. So even that, just going, okay, that's become a little more normal now. And it was sort of embarrassing to process how much of an absence it felt like those first few days. But I'm really grateful for just sort of like the work God has done. And the hope is that that can just sort of be a continued pattern. Because my big thing is I feel like I'm constantly fighting this battle against sort of reflexive things I do that are just wastes of time. And I want the reflexive things I do to be a little bit more beneficial or productive. And even things going, okay, when I feel the need to like, oh, this is when I'd normally take my phone out and check email. Like maybe just pray, maybe just be present, maybe just observe the world around you.
Right.
So,
you know, I wonder if any of that has to do with also the fact that like you really don't do social media. And so I feel like when I don't check, I don't check my email 10 times a day or whatever. But how many times like I open Instagram or Facebook or whatever, I wonder if it's that same space in you that a lot of us do with social media.
I think it is. And even to that point, I download Instagram on Thursdays and delete it Thursday night.
Yeah, that's
and
smart.
That's it. And because I like it becomes a compulsive thing if not. And the there's a reason for that. I didn't just like have some awakening someday and decide I'm just above this. It was I'm compulsively checking Instagram when I just don't need to.
The most embarrassing thing is when you open your phone, you open Instagram, then you say to yourself, I don't need to be on Instagram. You get out of it and immediately open it again.
Your finger just
lands back
weird,
on
weird like muscle memory thing.
Yeah,
it's no good. And then second thing, super fast, was a few of us from the discipleship department got to go to a conference put on by 24/7 Prayer.
I heard about
in San Francisco, and it was awesome. Got to hear a lot of speakers who I've read their books and listened to them on podcasts, and just people I really look up to. And and even, you know, one of them was able to like share with them how we've used his material in our men's ministry.
Who was your favorite?
John Tyson just preached the house
John
down.
Tyson was there.
He was extraordinary. And I mean, I am processing a lot of what I heard from him, and it really convicted me and inspired me in a lot of ways. So it was neat. I haven't been to like a conference in years, probably. So it's a fun time. I have a brother who lives in the Bay, so we got to have lunch when we were there, and just the whole thing. It was a fun time. So that's it. We'll be right back.
So, you know, we talk about, you know, social issues a lot on this podcast, and sometimes they get political. But we've had a lot of moments, Pastor Brian, where we've been thinking about what do we want to talk about on the podcast, and we've decided not to cover the election or not to talk about whatever the latest development is in the upcoming election, which is like less than 30 days out, just a side note.
Crazy.
But a lot of times we've decided not to, and we've been really intentional about that. Why is that? Why have you felt sometimes the need to say, like, hey, let's not deal with the election on this week's episode?
There are a few reasons, but the primary one is this, is that I have a really strong conviction that pastors, when operating in their official capacity, should not be trying to influence how people vote. Mm-hmm. Now, I think we need to teach biblical principles. I think we need to help folks understand the primacy of love. We need to help folks understand humility. We need to help folks understand the image of God in every person and how every life, whether it's in the womb or in another country or elderly or in jail or whatever, like every life is precious in God's sight. And on I could go about kind of ethical principles in terms of what do we value as Christians. So I do think it is our job to do that. And if anything, I think the centrality of politics in our lives, one of the ways it's such a bummer is that even as a pastor, I feel this tension, I don't know if you do, Pastor Judah, of going, okay, I want to talk about Christian ethical principles, but our society shoots these issues through a political lens. Mm. So I feel like we as pastors can't even talk about things sometimes if we're going to stay true to that principle of like, I don't even want to give the appearance of I'm trying to tell somebody how to vote. So I don't know. Do you resonate with that tension at all?
I think the tension that I wrestle with a lot is on the one hand, I know that there are a lot of people who intentionally disconnect from like news and media because the ways that politics is covered is overwhelming and scary and often antagonistic and inflammatory.
Right.
And we don't want to do that. I also wrestle with just the importance of, you know, knowing our elections have consequences, and I really believe as a Christian in my responsibility to participate in, you know, the system of governing that happens in my country. And so wanting to make sure that people are informed in a way that's like not as inflammatory.
Yeah.
And so sometimes for me, the decision to not cover a particular thing has a lot to do with what is the benefit of talking about this, right? Like what information are people receiving that they maybe haven't received, or how is it being helpful? And I'm kind of looking at this like, okay, if something has happened that is just simply salacious or has some entertainment value, but it's not actually helpful in like how we live our lives as Christians, then I don't want to talk about it. And there's been a lot of that in this election, and that's how often pundits cover election news. And so we just are always trying to be careful, because I agree. I think that we really don't want to tell people how to vote, and certainly not, we don't want to tell people who to vote for.
Yeah.
We want to talk about issues and Christian perspectives on issues.
Yeah.
But we want to be really, really careful because we understand that people make their political decisions from deeply, deeply personal places.
Yeah.
And we don't all come from the same place. Yeah. We don't all have the same experience. So I don't know.
Then that experience element is really important. Another side of this that is challenging is, I've been pretty open about the fact that I'm nonpartisan but not neutral, certainly in the presidential election. And part of, I've kind of done what you've just described, Pastor Judah, and I've largely disconnected from election news because I know who I'm voting for. Like, pretty much nothing is going to change that. And I just, like, even, I literally don't know what the latest polls say, and I don't need to know. I don't want to know. It does not change my life at all.
Nothing.
I'm going to participate in the election regardless, but I don't need to know every little thing that happens.
I think that there's something valuable as well about not looking at politics as a reality show. And you use the analogy often of like the way we look at sports teams, right? Like yeah. us versus them.
Yeah.
And I think being overly invested in like the latest updates can make it feel like a game in a way that it's just not a game.
It's
like
not.
Like these politics have real implications for our lives. So I think for myself, holding myself accountable to making sure that my practice of consuming information is not, you know, doesn't turn into kind of this reality show yeah. type thing.
And I think another reason why I've hesitated to talk more about the election on the podcast, and this kind of relates to the earlier point I was making, is just even assessing facts can sound like it's motivated by some sort of bias. And I really try to be as unbiased as possible, but I recognize every human being has bias. So
sure.
even to talk about basic facts of this was what was said and this is why this is a problem from a Christian perspective, for example, is what that comes across as, oh, you're pro that person or anti that person, yeah. when the truth is I'm anti the principle or yeah. I'm pro the principle.
Or the behavior,
and if,
or whatever.
And if the person, I don't care if their name is Donald Trump or Kamala Harris or anything else, if the person is behaving in this manner, I'm going to say, like, for me, that is morally problematic or morally praiseworthy or whatever. And I think that, I mean, and even that's just something I would ask for from our listeners or those who listen to me preach, is just to recognize, like, when I comment on things, it's never about the person, and certainly, God help me, never about the party, but it is. It's about the conduct, and that's even a principle that we've brought to this show of going, if we're going to talk about politics, it's always going to be about the conduct and not the personality.
You know, I really wrestle with that whole, the ways that sometimes it is seen as partisan when you're just assessing facts, and I really wrestle a lot with what is my responsibility to, like, there are times where I say, okay, you know, we shouldn't talk about this particular thing because it's going to seem like it is that we're being partisan, even
sure.
though we're just saying, hey, this is what happened, and this is kind of how the Bible would inform that or Christian worldview would inform that, and we choose not to talk about that. And I wrestle with that because how much of that is, like, our responsibility, right?
Yep.
Like at some point, I think we just have to be a little more intellectually honest. And that's difficult. And so sometimes we just decide, hey, for the sake of peace, right? And I really use this. This is a biblical principle, right? When Jesus said, give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, in a lot of ways, just saying, like, look, there are some battles that we fight, and there are some that we say, you know what? I don't need to have a public, you yeah. know, kerfuffle about this.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Now, in all of this, we still are preparing to vote.
Correct.
We're going to participate in the process.
Correct. Want to be really clear about that.
You are very pro-voting, as am I.
100%.
I vote in every election, even the small ones. And how are you going about preparing yourself to vote?
Yeah, well, the first thing is I think it's really, really important to check your registration status.
Yep.
And you can do that very, very easily. You can just type check my registration status in Google, and it'll pull up a gang ton of websites that can help you. In California, it's a little bit easier for us. Our voting system is pretty efficient and pretty easy. But in other places, it's more difficult. And so to check what are going to be the requirements when I get to the polls,
yep.
Or if I'm voting by mail, you know, when do I have to have my pink envelope in the mail
right.
To go out? So I think that that's really, really important. And I know that there are a lot of people who, you know, would say, hey, I live in California, my vote doesn't mean anything. But it really, 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 really does. And so check your registration. And then the other thing that I really appreciate is that we get a little booklet that gets mailed out to us in California with all the issues and candidates that are, you know, going to be on the upcoming election. And so to spend a little bit of time just doing your research. And one of the things that I like to do, I actually have voting parties because I vote by mail.
Mm-hmm.
And so I call, you know, a few friends who don't see things exactly the way I do, but where there's a lot of trust
yep.
and a lot of respect and a lot of honor. And we just sit around over a good cup of wine, glass of wine, and just talk about the issues and our perspectives on them so
yeah.
that by the time it's time for me to vote, I'm already at least familiar with some of the issues that are coming before me. And I know that that can be really, really overwhelming. And so what I would encourage you to do always is start with The websites of the issues, right? So if it's prop, whatever number, right? There's a pro prop, let's say Z, and an anti-prop Z. Go to their websites and read how they're talking about it, right? Look at how organizations that are doing organizing work that you really support, whether it's, pro-family work or whatever, see how they're thinking about the issues.
Right.
And then, you know, make your decisions. What about you? Yeah. What does it look like to prepare to vote for you?
Similar. I think it's definitely reading the voter guide that gets sent in the mail, and we want to be careful. We're talking about the one that comes from the Secretary of State's office, not some weird voter guide sponsored by God knows who. Pay no attention to those. But, you read through that, and even in those guides, often you'll find the kind of the pro side of different propositions, the against side, and then each side gets to submit a rebuttal to the counter argument for their side. So I find that to be helpful. This goes without saying, and I hope and pray that this would be like obvious to a mature Christian person.
We believe you, Jesus.
But that it's very much about what do I not do? I'm not going to pay any attention to someone who tries to tell me one side is good and the other side is evil, because they're just straight up lying. And spiritual maturity requires something better of us than to give ourselves over to one side that significantly. So certainly there is no value in paying attention to someone who's super far right or super far left, or whose agenda is simply to seek the power of their side, not the good of society. So, and that's easy for me. Like, I just have no interest, and I'm just enough of a, like, I don't know. I'm a contrarian by nature. So even when I hear something like this, like super one-sided, I'm just forming counter arguments in my mind. So I think it's really careful that we're avoiding that. And then also, I've got trusted friends like you who I'll chat with them about, and I kind of get their perspective on different issues. And I want to emphasize too that for me, the process of preparing to vote takes a couple of hours. It does not take weeks. I'm not breathlessly reading everything I can get my hands on. That I'm actually just living my life, trying to follow Jesus, work a job, be a husband, be a father, have hobbies, go outside, whatever. And I'm not letting this dominate my life. And there is so much temptation, I think, because politics is a business, news is a business. There are so many people with a really deep incentive to get us paying attention to politics constantly. And I'm not saying they're bad people. Like, that's their job. But that's not healthy. And I'm not going to be healthy if I'm just spending October obsessing over the upcoming election. One more thing I'll add is, as much as I try, or two more things. Number one, when it comes to elections with people, like right now, I have a like really simple yes or no sort of moral question that if their answer to that is no, then I will not vote for them.
I keep forgetting to ask you about that offline. Remind me later.
Yes, I'm not going to say what it is online in light of my previous thing about not trying to influence people and how to vote. But that's a really, really simple one for me that I could not in good conscience vote for somebody whose answer and whose life says their answer to that question is no, and certainly would violate kind of my life principle of do not do things that I could not explain to my children without appearing to be a hypocrite. So that's a really simple one. It's theoretically possible that both people in an election could answer no to that, but that makes honestly a lot of
what do you do in that case? Because I feel like there are going to be a lot of people who are in that position where there are, you know, two candidates, whether we're talking about at the top of the ticket or the bottom.
Yeah.
Who are not satisfactory. I think a lot of times the news are called double haters.
Sure.
What is that?
Well, it's silly. I mean, everybody goes, oh, it's just the lesser of two evils. Well, yeah, duh. Jesus isn't on the ballot. Every election, if you and I were running for something, county supervisor or whatever, guess what? People got to choose the lesser of two evils.
You are the lesser of two evils between the two of us. 100%.
Well, we'll see. But I think that's sort of a silly game we play to try to sort of lump people together.
Yeah.
But I will say this, like, again, my question is a really big deal for me. And if your answer to that question is no, I don't want you being in leadership anywhere. Like, I just don't. And
so would you just like
so
not
I would just not
question.
Vote. Yeah. If both people were a no to that, I wouldn't vote.
Okay.
And also another rule I have for myself is I don't cast an ignorant vote. Like, I do my best to educate myself about the different candidates.
Yeah.
But if I don't have time or, you know, whatever, I'm not going to just, well, I like that person's name, or, hey, I don't really care what letter's next to their name. But, like, I'm not going to just vote based on whatever. If I don't know what's a little bit about the individual, I'm not going to vote. So that's a challenge for me to go, okay, let's make sure you actually do your homework and know what you're doing.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that that's correct. And I think the last thing that I'll add that is part of my voting experience is I always do kind of really just take just a second. You know, I come from people who really had to fight for their right to vote.
Yeah.
Right. And there are a lot of us like that. If you're a person of color, if you're indigenous, if you're black, if you're a woman.
Woman. Yeah.
There are a lot of folks who, you know, our ancestors really like paid for our opportunity. And so I just kind of sit with that. And to everybody else who maybe doesn't fit in one of those categories, just the idea that we live in a democracy where you get to vote. I mean, I was visiting a country not too long ago. And wherever in that country, the county that you're born in is the county that you vote for the rest of your life, even if you move.
That's crazy.
And so there are people who will move to the other side of that country and then have to drive 15 hours to get back to the county of their birth to cast their vote. And if they don't vote and they haven't gotten an exemption, which you have to fill out all this paperwork to get an exemption from voting, you get fined. You can lose your job. And you can, at the worst, you can go to jail not voting.
Wow.
And so, you know, you take a second just to celebrate, like, you know, listen, my little United States of America has a lot of issues, 100%. I'm most critical of my own country because it's the country that I love. Yep. However, I have been to 36 countries in this world. There's not one other democracy that I would more rather be critical of and have to engage with and live in than my own. And so to just remember that the right to vote is something precious that not everybody has.
Yeah, it's something to thank God for, and it is not something to take for granted. So that's 100%. Very well said. We'll be right back. We are back, and Pastor Judah, we came across an article that was published about a month ago on Vox called The Impossible Promise of Making It, and the article starts like this. Land your dream job by 25, buy a house at 30, earn enough money to put your bills on auto pay, and still have enough left over to save. Somehow find time to run a few marathons while also maintaining a tight-knit group of friends. According to some, these are the markers of a good life, a sign that you've made it, and that elusive goal signifying maturity and success. And the article goes on to talk about how kind of the economic and social landscape has shifted, and that these goals are seemingly no longer attainable or desirable for huge quantities of people. I mean, recent Pew Center research analysis of Census Bureau data found that young adults are less likely to have a full-time job, be financially independent, live on their own, get married, and have a child compared to the young adults of the 1980s. And essentially, Pastor Judah, the whole article goes on to just talk about kind of this social pressure a lot of us feel to quote unquote make it, defined by attaining certain, I don't know, status symbols in life. Yeah. And as I read this, I find it problematic. And I think on some level you do as well. What is your reaction to some of this?
You know, I'm really wrestling with it because on the one hand, I do think that there's some significant, there's significant lack of health in the ways that we kind of measure what it looks like to make it. I think social media really shapes that and what have you. But on the other hand, I think that there is something innately human about needing to have measurements, measurement markers. And so I think what it is not that we're trying to, that we're saying, hey, you should not have these things as measuring measure markers in your life, but what do they measure, right? Yeah. And I would rather it measure things like the passage of time, be useful for assessing, okay, what is it that I want? What would be life-giving? As opposed to measuring how, like, successful I am as a human, right? Like, and I think that this also ranges culturally. And so different cultures have different ways of thinking about success, for example. In the United States, you know, we kind of like, hey, you turn 18, get out, go to college and get married and have kids. In other countries, you know, you live with your parents until you're married, and that can be well into your 30s.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering how much of what is in what we're struggling with in this article is based on the idea that maybe those are not our personal kind of cultural importance markers or success markers versus that that it's bad as a whole. Does that make sense?
Right. I think so. I think I'm tracking on what you're saying. It is easier than ever to kind of have values imported on us.
Yeah, 100%.
In part because in days gone by, our ability to compare ourselves with others was fairly limited. If I didn't know you personally,
I
really had no idea what was going on with you.
Yeah, that's right.
Whereas now, through social media, which is not entirely bad, we have access to an unlimited number of individuals. So I could go on Instagram and easily find 100 accounts that will give me advice on how to be a better dad.
Yeah, and that will also show you the most polished, clean, yes, successful versions of people.
And if I engage with the content from even a small fraction of those accounts, what am I going to do? I'm going to feel overwhelmed. I'm going to feel inadequate. I'm going to feel like I'm not doing enough.
100%.
And that's just one example. And my point is not to say that those who are seeking to help people be better dads or better anythings are evil or wicked or we ought not pay attention to them. I subscribe to a few dad podcasts that are helpful to me. That what we need to recognize is that whoever we are and whatever we value, when we get stuck in this comparison loop,
yeah, that's right,
it is a game we cannot win. And anytime we're going, oh, well, once I've done this, I will have made it. Once I've done this, I will have made it.
Yeah, that's right.
I think that is a fallacy that harms us and keeps us stuck more than it helps us move forward.
Well, and I think that there are two major issues. One is that this kind of way of looking and measuring our life keeps us kind of perpetually striving and less likely to enjoy where we are. You couldn't wait to graduate college. Oh my gosh, I just want to graduate college. And then you graduated and now you look back and you say, oh man, I missed college. I really wish you couldn't wait to not be single anymore.
Yeah.
And then you get married and you're like, man, I can't travel the way I used to. I'm having to, whatever.
Right.
And so I think that leads to the second issue, which is that this way of kind of measuring our success gives this kind of overly rosy perspective on all of these goals. It's like, I can't wait to have children. I just really want. And then you have children and you're like, I can't stand these little rugrats. Get out.
Yeah.
I can't wait to get married. And then you're like, oh wait, marriage is hard. I can't wait to get into a master's program. And then the master's program is difficult. Or I can't wait to have, my dream career.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't allow us to really, I think, do an accurate assessment of what do those things mean for my actual day-to-day life.
And the article names exactly what you're talking about. They call it the arrival fallacy.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, one of the more powerful forces preventing us from feeling like we've quote-unquote made it is the ability to acclimate to both great and not so great events, a concept known as hedonic adaptation. I've referred to this, though not by this name before, even when talking about money, that anytime you get a raise, you're like, oh my gosh, wow, I have so many more resources. And then by your second paycheck at your new pay scale, you're like, how did I ever survive on less than this? Right?
Yeah,
and I think that's true in a lot of ways. The article says, even if you check off every item on a laundry list of goals, the euphoria and bliss will subside and you'll inevitably want for more again. And I think that's part of living in a fallen world. I think that's part of kind of this striving for an ultimate sense of identity in the things of this world. And man, what a powerful reminder that is of just, at the end of the day, my identity is in Christ, and what is most important about me is that I'm a child of God.
Yeah.
And then even then on some level to go, this sort of hard to define social pressure that I might feel to be a certain kind of way, what is the benefit to paying attention to it? I feel like I hear so much about there's so much pressure on women. There's so much pressure on men. There's so much pressure on young adults. And I just want to ask the question, where is this pressure coming from?
Yeah, yeah.
And is it really real?
Yeah. Well, I think that's the whole thing about social pressure is that it's not actually real.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that it's not perceived and experienced as real. And so I think the key here is for us to, one, take a holistic approach, right?
Yeah.
And the article talks about that, this idea that making it is not a singular moment or a singular achievement, right? But that your life is this vast amalgamation of events and experiences. And for believers, I think that this is why it is so important to understand that you're, and I teach this to my young adults, when we talk about, what are you going to do with your life? that your first answer actually has to be like, do my best to honor God.
Yeah.
Right. And then everything else is details. And like, if that is the goal, if my goal is, I just want to really like, I want to please my Savior.
Yeah.
Then really success looks all kinds of different ways. Yeah. Right. You can, whether you have some of the things that are on these lists, like get married and get a college degree and have children and make a lot of money, whether that happens or not, at the end of the day, and I think that this is going to be just so stark for us, you know, when Jesus comes back, it's like so many of these things that we just died over.
Yeah.
We're going to be like in heaven talking about something, y'all remember we were so stupid and we used to just like fall apart over this or that and think that this was like the most important thing.
Yeah.
When really it's not. Our perspective is an eternal one.
Yeah.
Right. And so in the context of eternity, like for sure, don't misunderstand me. Go to college. Right. Go get that degree. But I promise you it's not going to help you in heaven. I promise you it's not in eternity. It's, you know.
Well, and I think we have to ask the question, why am I making the decisions I'm making? Yeah. Am I making the decisions out of a sense of calling? Am I making the decisions out of a sense of personal interest? And is this in line with my values? And does it honor God? I think that too often when we get stuck in the comparison trap, we can make decisions out of a desire to appear impressive.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think there was a time in my life where I really cared a lot about positive attention. And I realized, oh my gosh, like, I care a lot about positive attention from strangers. And I just, and I think in this day and age, all of us have the opportunity to live our lives through that lens of kind of performing for strangers on social media and everything else.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, to realize like that, again, that's just a game I can't win. Like it's just, I'm going to crave it more and more and more. So to go, instead of, okay, I need to accomplish X, Y, and Z so that I can appear impressive before some mix of friends and strangers online, instead to be able to go, okay, what does it mean to live faithfully today? And rather than being worried about getting this affirmation from the outside world, how do I live a life before God and others that is honoring to Him, that is honoring to those people, that makes a genuine difference in the lives of others and allows me to look at myself at the end of the day and go, okay, in as far as I can tell, I did the best I could with the gift of this day that I was given. And I think that this perspective of going, I want the people that know me best to respect me most.
Yeah.
And if I'm trying to live up to some impossible standard online, I'm going to alienate the people whose opinion really matters.
That's what I was thinking a lot about, is like that this conversation isn't about not like not being ambitious.
Yeah.
But like also that ambition really needs to take a back seat to a couple of things. And one of those things is relationships, right? That like I want to live a deeply relational life. And what I have found is that often my ambition has really gotten in the way of that. You know, when my parents who, you know, live maybe 45 minutes away are like, hey, we never see you. You never come. And I'm like, well, I never have time. That's a problem, right?
Okay. So you even say that, though. And I guess I would reframe that a little bit to go, are we ambitious for the right things?
Yeah, that's good.
Like, I think even, okay, am I ambitious to have a healthy family life?
Yeah,
am I ambitious to have a healthy marriage? Am I ambitious to prioritize the things that will lead to my thriving and that will honor God? Because man, oh man, when we get stuck in that comparison trap, our ambition priorities can get all out of whack.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. We end up doing things that we don't, some of us don't even really like. Like, yeah, I mean, I can't tell you how many of people I've talked to, and they will be lamenting about being single. And then you keep listening and you ask the question, do you actually want to be married? And there's like a pause and they're like, and you're like, okay, so let's process that.
And how often behind that is there, spoken or unspoken, well, I feel like I should.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay, why?
Yeah.
And I think anytime any of us feel this, I feel like I should X.
Question it.
It is worth questioning. And that's not to say there's not a good answer.
That's right.
Maybe you should because it's the right thing to do for any number of reasons.
That's right.
But just to go, is this honoring to the Lord and in line with my values and not just something I'm doing for the sake of appearing a certain kind of way?
Yeah.
I think that ultimately, I think that is what it means to make it, to kind of be free from the need to prove yourself that you're making it to others.
To be healthy.
Yep. Amen. We'll be right back. For our last topic, we are looking at an article from Christianity Today, and the headline is this: Evangelicals struggle to preach life in the top country for assisted death. And it goes on to speak about Canadian pastors and churches and how they are engaging with a program called MAID in Canada, called Medical Assistance in Dying, and just how they're wrestling with the topic of the right to end one's life for any number of reasons. I mean, not any number of reasons, but kind of the idea of like they're terminal or there's something going on that's irreversible. And we figured that would be a good opportunity to talk about euthanasia. And we've sort of specifically avoided getting too personal between Pastor Judah and I in terms of even explaining our own views to each other. Yeah. So we're going to learn some things even as we have this conversation. So Pastor Judah, let's just start us off. Like what are some of the factors you're weighing when you think about euthanasia? Because it's not just an issue in Canada. Yeah, there are multiple right-to-die states in the United States, including California.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a pretty complicated thing because there are folks who argue for compassionate death talk about the importance of not making people suffer if you have, you know, metastasized stage 4 cancer and it's going to be just a rough road and until you transition or you're going to be in like unbearable pain. You know, people who are pro this opportunity say that we should allow people to die with dignity, but also with autonomy, right? The right to make that own decision. They believe that it can reduce unnecessary suffering and that it really is a kind of a core tenet of freedom. On the other hand, you know, people who argue against it feel like it really undermines the value of human life.
Yeah.
As well as there's this, and this is something that I am processing, is like, what are the ways that it can be abused or misused, right? And you can, you know, your imagination can just spiral with all of the ways that you could see that happening. And also, I wonder about if it is an option, right? Like if I know, hey, if I get bad news from the doctor, I can talk to my doctor and decide to, you know, have a peaceful lethal injection and pass. Is there then going to be this pressure on folks who maybe don't have as much money, right? Who'd say, well, let me just go ahead and transition out rather than pay for all of this healthcare or leave my family with all of this medical debt. And so there's this kind of mixed bag of arguments both for and against it. And I think for me, there's also this like, you know, really wanting to protect life and like having value for life. And, you know, I really do. I mean, I think that this is one of those moments where like you realize that the conversation about being pro-living just extends so much farther than just, you know, conversations about abortion. But, you know, everything from abortion to death penalty to this. And so I'm really conflicted about it. What are some of the things that have kind of gone into how you're thinking about this as an issue?
Yeah, I'm conflicted on it too. And I often sort of joke that my views on euthanasia are kind of the one strike against my pro-life record. I'm pro-life on abortion. I'm pro-life on the death penalty. I'm pro-life on guns. I'm pro-life on war. I'm very sort of anti-killing in a lot of ways. And
that's good, Pastor.
At the same time, well, and not out of, well, I mean, you want to talk about the angriest I have made Christians ever.
100%.
Probably over the issue of violence and can Christians commit acts of violence, especially in the name of the state. I have endless respect for military personnel, veterans, and everything else, but there are, I think, real questions about can we make a positive case from the New Testament for engaging in violence, for the government taking life, and we just are in such a culture where that is taken for granted
that
you start to challenge those things and people get upset. Anyway, there is a big side of me that goes, okay, if I know I have 6 weeks to live, and those 6 weeks are going to be miserable, unbearably painful, ought I have the right to choose to end my life in that moment under the care of a doctor with, you know, appropriate interventions and help? And I personally, and I'm not speaking on behalf of Bridgeway or anyone else, I personally have a hard time answering that question no, as an isolated case.
Yeah,
now, at the same time, I have a real challenge with all of the different ways that could be abused, that there is pressure on folks. I mean, my dad was a physician for his entire career. I remember him saying that we spend an inordinate amount of money on the last year of someone's life from a healthcare perspective. And he said, the problem is we just don't know when that year begins and that we could probably save ourselves a lot of money by just sort of recognizing, but of course it's impossible to know. So, and I'll tell you this, one thing that the article raises, somebody who's very much against medical assistance in dying, a pastor in Alberta, says that I think one of the strongest reasons why MAID has a lot of traction generally in our society is that nobody wants to talk about death. Everyone just wants to kind of sweep it under the rug and keep it as sterile and as short as possible. And I think there is something to that, to go, so many uncomfortable things in life we're able to avoid. Heck, I have no idea where my trash goes when I bring it to the sidewalk, right? I don't have to watch, you know, my food get prepared. I don't have to watch, you know, any of those things go on. And even to go, okay, death can kind of happen behind closed doors where I don't have to think about it or see it or whatever. Like, I think that's a fair argument to go, we ought not be sweeping this under the rug or pretending like it doesn't exist. So again, on the one hand, I think as an isolated incident, I think folks should have that right. But there are so many other factors. Like, the last thing I would want is for someone to be pressured into that situation, to feel like their family or their doctors are trying to tell them that their life is not valuable and they ought just end it now. So I don't know. I'm conflicted.
Also, I think it's also really, really hard to come up with like some sort of standard of like I's that have to be dotted and T's that have to be crossed in order to qualify for this. You know, how do we make that decision? How do we decide? So do we say, hey, if you only have 6 weeks, is it a time thing? And if you're like at 8 weeks, you have 8 weeks to live, then you don't qualify. Is it that the cancer has spread so far?
Yeah.
Right. And so you could see that getting really, really sticky pretty, pretty quickly.
Yeah.
I think additionally, just as a Christian, I'm wondering about the risk of trying, of limiting what God can do. Right?
Yep. No, that's true.
And so, yeah, you know, that gets weird. We just had worship, prayer, and healing, and, you know, we really believe for miracles. You know, and so do we tell somebody, hey, you should suffer these 6 weeks because God might heal you?
Yeah.
When maybe it's on like, you're just like wrestling with all of those things. And so for me, I also think that, look, I have never battled end of life terminal illness personally.
Right.
But I also feel like that there our healthcare is advanced enough to give you some other options for what that experience is.
Yeah.
Toward the end.
Yeah, it is. And I think there is a real wrestling and a real challenge to draw the line to go, okay, where are we sort of holding out for a miracle? And where are we kind of accepting that, like, sort of God has made it clear, as clear as we can understand that my life is going to end, another person's life is going to end, and that part of Christian living is actually walking alongside someone in dying.
That's
That there comes a point where we go, okay, like, perhaps God's will in this situation is that from a place of acceptance, we honor this person and honor the Lord as the life ends, as opposed to always acting as though the miraculous is what needs to take place. Because 100% of people die. Like, I don't know if you're aware of this. I'll pray for anyone, anywhere, anytime for 100%. Anything. And
big
I'm not
prayers.
In any way suggesting we ought to be anti-prayer for the sick and the dying. But I just think there's a wrestling to go, can God be honored?
That's right. A discernment that needs to happen.
By our accepting of death. And that's not to say that we ought to necessarily be approving of medical assistance in all cases. But I do think that there is, to the point of the pastor in this article, to go, there is a level of discomfort with death that causes us to want to avoid it in any number of ways.
Yeah.
Maybe part of that is by shortcutting the process of death. And maybe part of it is by acting as though we have authority over death in this life completely, which we simply don't, right?
Well, and I think that another piece to this that I'm thinking about is, what is the impact on our medical community, right?
Yeah.
So, like, I could see a situation where somebody, you know, maybe your dad lives in Minnesota and, you know, he gets sick, he doesn't tell anybody, he finds out that he's got 6 weeks to live, and he decides to, you know, to have this compassionate, you know, death, the euthanasia. And then you find out, you know, that week, And then you're ready to sue the hospital because, well, he shouldn't have made this. I just think that it opens up a can of worms, that there is not enough agreement or alignment in values and perspective and experience to be worth opening. And so instead, I would rather us really focus on, like, okay, what would it take? What would it look like to, you know, build our society up to be like a just more healthy society? Like, our mortality rates are higher than a lot of other places, right? And so I haven't arrived at a hard position, but I am leaning toward, I don't know that it is worth it to open up that can of worms and all of the other issues that will come out of it. And so while I certainly hate to see people suffer, it is not my heart. I think I would rather say, okay, Lord, granddad is struggling and he's been in a lot of pain. Go ahead and come and get him, you know, rather than, I think, have to open up the legal, the medical, the emotional. There are just so many pieces that I'm not convinced.
And I've walked alongside folks in that situation. I've walked alongside that with members of my family, looking at other family members going like, okay, it is sort of gracious that this individual had an amazing life and now it's coming to an end. And, you know, we can thank God for their life and ask God, would you relieve their suffering? So it's a complicated moral question. 100%. And I would encourage those who are listening to check out the link in the show notes. It's definitely a perspective from pastors in Canada where they're pushing back against this pretty hard. And I think for, even as somebody who's a little conflicted on the topic, I think for good reason. It is used quite a lot in Canada. And I certainly, as we both expressed, we have some fear of the abuse of it. But I think it is worth us considering.
Sure.
How do we think about death as a Christian? How do we appropriately value the sacredness of life while maintaining a hope that goes beyond the grave? To know that death, while it leads to sadness and separation, mourning and loss, that is an enemy that has been defeated.
That's right.
And how does that impact the way we think about these things? So I think it's fair to say, Pastor Judah, neither you nor I are being super dogmatic about the topic, but I think it's worth us considering, what does it mean for us?
Yeah, I feel like I'm leaning toward no, and it feels like you're leaning toward yes. Would you say that's accurate?
I think that's fair. That's fair. With I can't say anything without a qualifier, but the caveat that I have real fear of abuse.
Sure. Leaning.
All right, we'll be right back.
So one thing about me, Pastor Brian, I love old people. I love children and
old
people.
Yes, you do.
You folks in the middle get on my nerves, but children and old people, my folks. So there's this really interesting article from BuzzFeed called Older Adults Are Calling Out Things They Think Are a Huge Waste of Money. And so I want to spend the rest of our time on today's episode having a little fun looking at some of the things on this list. And I want each of us to pick one thing that older adults say is a huge waste of money that we agree with these older adults in, and one thing that we would argue, no, it's not a huge waste of money. So I'm going to let you go first with the thing that you are agree with.
That I agree with. I agree with most of the things on this list. And okay, the first one, it is so hard to choose. Most of these are terrible. Okay, so one that is in fact a huge waste of money, and this has been something I've really had to adjust my thinking on, buying cheap things. As the article says, over time, you will pay more for the appliance or piece of furniture, etc. if you start cheap. Look for value, the balance between durability and cost.
Yeah.
Research and waiting for sales is a good strategy. Also, find good quality secondhand furniture is a great deal. Yes and amen. I feel like so often through my 20s and even into my 30s, where money was really tight, I would find just going, okay, how can we get this thing for as cheaply as possible? And what happened would be is it inevitably would break in very short order, and sure enough, you end up replacing it.
That's
so
right.
My whole thing, and even this is very much the approach I carry to this day, is okay, I'm not paying extra money for like brand name or fanciness, but I want to buy something once and have it work. And financial limitations are what they are. I can't always buy as high quality a thing as I would want, but to be able to go, okay, rather than buy the $100 thing that I'm going to have to now just replace constantly. Heck, I'll give you, this is a dumb example. I hate buying belts. Belts are like just whatever. They're not fun. It's not fun to buy a new, it's not like buying a new shirt. Like, oh, this looks cool.
Look at my new shirt.
Like, whatever. It's a belt. And because of that, I would always buy cheap belts.
Yeah.
And I end up having to replace them so often because they break. So you want to know what
you
I did,
in
Pastor
my closet,
Judah?
Sir.
I found a website that guarantees their belts for 100 years.
What?
100 years.
I want to know what empirical evidence
100
there is.
Years. And I went and I waited till they had a sale. And it cost me about 2.5 times what I would normally pay for a belt.
Can I ask how much the belt was?
It was like, it was on sale. It was like $60.
Okay,
which
that's
is,
not
which
bad.
Is, yeah. you know, like not nothing. That's yeah, quite a bit for, certainly more than I would spend. But you know what
it's
I have?
A $12 Target belt.
I have a belt that's not going to break.
Come on.
And I'm not going to be spending money on belts for a very long time. So I am very anti, whenever possible, I'm very anti buying super cheap things that are only going to break. Buy something quality, have it work, and then not have to worry about it forever, both from a financial standpoint and just a worrying about it standpoint. How about
100%.
You?
Okay, so the one that I 100% agree with is that it is a waste of money to spend a lot of money on funerals.
Preach.
Listen, when I die, y'all put me in the trash bag, and y'all throw me in the dumpster, and y'all call it that. Y'all have a lovely party for me with some good food and some singing at somebody's house, and y'all call it a day. Don't y'all spend all this money on and I understand the impulse because you want to honor your folks. But also, I mean, I think this goes back to like something that we talked about before, which is like that social pressure. Who told us that you're supposed to have this real expensive $7,000 box that's going to be in the ground?
Right.
If you don't go to the local woodworking shop and have your cousin who likes to do woodwork carve you out a little pine box, I don't know. The only thing that I will say that I would spend some money on, and this is what I want to happen to me when I die, is you can get like the tree pods where basically your remains are like put into like a tree, like seed that like grows. And so I have this fantasy of like having this piece of land that has all these trees that are like all of our relatives. And you like walk through the creepy woods of like
the creepy woods of your ancestors.
And the birch tree, that's Auntie Sarah. We used to hate her. I always chop, I break a branch off every time I pass
gracious.
By.
Oh, this
but
is getting
anyway,
weird.
I just think that that's like too, it's just too much. We just, $5,000 caskets are just ridiculous.
Oh, take that money, spend it on literally anything else when I die.
That is
me telling my family members, please do not do that for me. Now, I'm
just about weddings.
Yeah, me too. And I think much of what folks have to go through to get married is just a gigantic waste of money. I also tell couples, like, do what's important to you.
Sure.
To kind of go back to our whole social pressure conversation from earlier, like, make your wedding something that is meaningful to you. If that means going big and you have the financial resources to do it, like,
don't!
Fine. Yeah,
don't!
Like, put a down payment on a house.
Yeah.
But like, I'm not here to criticize someone's choices.
Sure.
And I think on some level with funerals, it's the same.
Sure.
But also just to go, okay, is that $5,000 box really the best way? I mean, my goodness, take that money and donate it to a cause they cared about.
I mean, I just think about like how often, like, well, not how often, because I'm not like frequenting cemeteries often, but when I've gone to cemeteries, you know, sometimes you'll see the graves will be, you know, overrun with weeds or whatever.
Yeah.
That lets you know that somebody hasn't been here in a while.
Right.
And then you think about how much did you spend for this headstone?
Yeah.
And you can't, and it's not because you don't want to, it may be busy or time or whatever. It just, I don't know. It's too much.
Yep. Nope. I'm with you.
All right. I want you to now make an argument of one that you saw on this list that you think is worth spending a lot of money on.
Okay. Well, my honorable mentions for things that are a waste of money, going out to eat regularly. Mm. My goodness, I think about, man, my family affords to go out to like a moderate meal. Like, we're talking like $100, and I think that is just not in line with our family's values. If it is in line with yours, go for it. I think about designer clothes. I'm just like, I don't know. I'm like, clearance rack for the win. And the one that I'm going to choose to defend, I'm going to cheat because I'm not defending the sort of extreme example they give,
sure,
but I'm going to defend it in general. And they talk about the $100 water bottle, and the article has these pictures of Stanley's. Now, spending $100 on a water bottle is a little bit ridiculous. However, I do find that my like gigantic Yeti water bottle that was actually given to my wife as a gift, and she doesn't use it, and she passed it along to me. Like, I love that thing.
Mm.
It keeps my drinks cold all day long. I have another Stanley bottle that keeps my smoothie cold like all morning long. I kind of drink it throughout the morning. And having something that can keep your drink cold and that can allow you to kind of have a lot of water with you all the time, to me, like, that improves my quality of life. I have a relative who will constantly just like freeze reusable plastic bottles, which, okay, if you don't have the means, like, great, do that. But I try to explain to them, like, you understand, like, a water bottle can do this for you. And you don't have to be constantly freezing these sort of plastic bottles that break all the time. So, I don't know. I'm very pro having a decent
this
water bottle.
This episode is sponsored by Yeti and Stanley. You can use our promo code, Bridgeway. Right.
It won't work, but you can use it. Okay.
Do you, like, having the attachment to your water bottle now,
yep.
If you had to pay $100 for it today, knowing now how it's impacted your life, would you reach in your pocket and pull out that $100?
I would do the same thing I did when I bought my belt. I would wait till that $100 water bottle went on sale and I would buy it for significantly less than $100. Would I pay $100? No, I would not pay. That does seem a little excessive. So I'm agreeing.
For my Stanley.
Holy moly, that is a lot. So, but I think having a nice water bottle is a great thing to have. And if you don't lose it, which that is a big if, it can last for, you know,
when you spend that $100 on that bottle, also spend about $50 on a tile.
Yeah, seriously. So that's one of the few things that in my life that I don't have a tile attached to. I probably should. Okay, how about you? Which one are you going to defend?
So my honorary mentions for ones that I agree are a large waste of time are collections. I just find that most people who have collections don't actually engage with their collections. They just like the idea of them.
Okay.
Not everybody, but yeah. A lot of folks.
All right.
A lot of folks. But I'm going to make an affirmative argument for going out to eat regularly.
Okay.
I think that in the 90s, you know, my mother used to, we have food at home. It's cheaper to eat at home. But now, I just don't think that that's the case.
Okay, go on.
I really don't.
I'll let you make
the
case.
I just think that, like, you know, so say you want chicken Alfredo tonight, right?
Okay.
You text your wife, babe, I'm going to make us chicken Alfredo tonight. You're going to go to the store. By the time you finish buying all of those ingredients and the cost of gas and your time, mm-mm. you're spending the same thing you would have paid to get chicken Alfredo at the Cheesecake Factory.
Okay, first of all.
I do want to say, this is my caveat for this, that this is as somebody who does not have children.
Yeah.
I don't know what the experience is for you folks who procreated. So it might be different.
Yeah. Okay. So first of all, you got to plan ahead. So you're not just going to the grocery store to buy for one meal. Because if you are buying for one meal, you're right. That can get expensive. But I don't know, man. You go to the Cheesecake Factory. You both get the chicken Alfredo, especially if you have any sort of beverage. I'm not even talking about like beer or wine. I'm talking about a soda. You factor in tax and tip.
You need to drink water.
That is a $70 to $75 night minimum, which I'm not hating on it.
Sure,
like, if that's what you want to do, go for it. And like, my wife and I will go out to dinner on special occasions. But like, for her and I, like, we would rather, I think, just spend time doing, or just if we're going to spend that kind of money, it would be to maybe go to a concert or a game or something.
Sure.
But I very much challenge the idea that it is more expensive, even close to more expensive, to eat it at home. I don't know where you're shopping, but you might want to consider somewhere else.
Fair enough. I really love Sprouts, and Sprouts is a really expensive store.
Yeah, it is a little more expensive.
I also really want to argue for, this talks about, like, you shouldn't buy books. That, like, hey, you buy a book, you read it once, you never touch it again, it just takes up space in your house. I want you, dear BuzzFeed, I want you to know that you are on a slow fall to the hot place for saying that we should not buy books, talking about, we'll just go to the library. First of all, who is getting in their car and driving all the way to the library twice for a book to get it? Answer to absolutely not. I'm going to Borders. I'm buying a book that I'm not going to read. Well,
this is 1997?
Barnes & Noble's. I'm buying the book. Will I maybe not read it? Probably. Do I have a collection of books that I haven't read yet, that I haven't opened yet, that I just wanted to have? Maybe. Do I have books that I read one time and never read again? Probably. But you'll let me have my books.
I think you're arguing against your own position right here.
I don't want to talk about it anymore.
I am pro owning books, partially because I like to mark books up. But also, I mean, I read almost everything I read is digital these days.
Yeah, I was going to say, you have a tablet.
Where I have to be careful is just going that like excessive, because books are always going on sale. And to go, oh, okay, I'll just look at what books are on sale today. And then you end up buying three books that like a year later, you'll maybe read half of one.
Yeah.
So, but owning it, because to me, if I'm just reading a book for entertainment, sure, I'll check it out in the library, or usually I'll do a digital loan. But if I'm reading it to actually learn and apply something, I got to have that for later on so I can refer back to
my, it. My conspiratorial version of myself is coming out now where I'm like, what if one day they want us all to be dumb and they burn all the books? Have you not seen any apocalypse movies? This is what they do. They get rid of all the books. So you have to have your own. I'm buying my books.
Okay. All right. So be like Pastor Judah.
Be like
buy
me.
Your books.
That's a good piece of advice for just like living life. Be like me.
Be like Pastor Judah. I think we can all agree. Thanks for listening. We sure appreciate it. If you like what you heard, give us a rating or review wherever you listen, and be sure to join us next week on Engaging Culture. Bye-bye.